Hi there. We've got a lot we're really excited to tell you about, but I'm going to make this real quick so you can get to the episode. The deep dive is coming up at the end of January. The lineup of speakers is incredible and the range of topics is mind-blowing. You do not want to miss out on the last deep dive ever. Then the beta reader matchup is open once again with the matchups going out early in February. Sign up to kick your creative year off with a bang. Lastly, there's an amazing writer's workbook available, which will make the perfect gift for you or the writer in your life. Head to our website, The Shit About Writing, to find out more.
The holidays are almost here, and if you still have names on your list, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, so every gift feels special and thoughtfully chosen. I know our crowd would love the Book Nook Reading Valet. It's a wood holder for your book, your mug, your reading glasses, e-reader, and/or phone, so you can carry it from your room to your bedside to the bathtub. It has a 4.9 out of 5 rating on over 178 reviews. I also thought you guys would like, all of you pet lovers out there, would like the custom pet embroidered sweatshirt, so you can have a custom portrait of your animal on your sweater and have them with you all day. Uncommon Goods has something for everybody, from moms and dads, kids and teens, book lovers, sports fans and foodies, gardeners, crafters, readers and writers. You will find unforgettable gifts that are anything but ordinary. When you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. Every purchase is a chance to choose something remarkable and feel good about where your money goes, because you can make your money go farther this holiday season, because with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3.1 million to date. That is incredible stuff. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/tsnotya. That's uncommongoods.com/TSNOTYAW for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. Hi everyone. Today's guest lives with her husband and children in Texas, where she is a social worker. Her writing has appeared in Porterhouse Review, Ruminate Magazine, and Open Global Rights, among other publications. The Bright Years is her debut novel. It's my pleasure to welcome Sarah Damoff. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bianca. Thank you so much for having me today. I'm excited to talk about The Shit No One Tells You About Writing.
Yeah, we're excited to have you as well, because we have a bit of a history with you and the show, which we will discuss shortly. Before then, for our listeners, those of you who are watching on the YouTube channel, I am holding up my highly marked up copy of The Bright Years, beautiful cover. I'm going to read you the flat copy now so that you have context for what we're busy discussing. So Ryan and Lillian Bright are deeply in love, recently married and now parents to a baby girl, Georgette. But Lillian has a son she hasn't told Ryan about, and Ryan has an alcohol addiction he hasn't told Lillian about. So Georgette comes of age watching their marriage rise and fall. When a shocking blow scatters their fragile trio, Georgette tries to distance herself from reminders of her parents. Years later, Lillian's son comes searching for his birth family, so Georgette must return to her roots, unearth her family's history, and decide whether she can open up to love for them or herself while there's still time. Told from three intimate points of view, The Bright Years is a tender, true-to-life novel that explores the impact of each generation in a family torn apart by tragedy, but over time restored by the power of grace and compassion. All right, Sarah, before we dive into the book, and there's so much to unpack, like I say, highly marked up here. I think you were in our 2022 deep dive, and I put you in touch with Laurie Grassi, who was one of the speakers there. Can you take us through that?
Yes, definitely. So I've never done a deep dive, but I did see or hear her name through your podcast. And was it it was late 2022. I, at the time, was still learning about the avenues to publishing and was thinking that I might go with a small publisher or a hybrid publisher. And so I thought it would be helpful to find an independent editor who I knew, you know, had some credibility. And I reached out to you and you put me in touch with Lori, and she did do an edit of The Bright Years, and it was wonderful.
Just on that, I mean, Lori doesn't, for the rest of our listeners who are like, I need to contact Lori Grassi, she doesn't really take these kinds of cases. She works with publishers and editors at publishing houses, and they will outsource sort of publishing to her. So, you know, when Sarah reached out, I was like, well, I can try and put you in touch with Lori, but she doesn't really do this kind of thing. So let's see how it goes. She'll probably need to see a sample of your work and then she'll consider it. So the fact that Lori took you on, Sarah, was like at that time already a huge compliment. Kudos to you. Can you take us through the rest of your publishing journey and then what made you change your mind in terms of a small publisher? Did you get an agent? How did the rest of that look?
Yes, great question. And I'll give a few details I don't always give, because as an avid listener to your show, I know this is what listeners love to hear. So as I learned about the different paths to publishing, it was really, I saw the benefits in each path, and it was really that I was learning more about my own goals. So as I looked into hybrid publishing, a lot of the other people that I learned that were publishing through it were maybe only interested in publishing one book. They had a memoir, they needed to tell their story, they wanted to tell their story. And I began to realize, I have a lot of books in me. I want to do this as a career. I want to keep going. I want the wider distribution. And so that's when I kind of switched to start thinking, I should maybe look for an agent and pursue traditional publishing, and had a lot of encouragement to do that. And so I started doing that. I had done it kind of half-heartedly previously. I'd sent out query letters, I think, before I even knew the phrase query letter. So they weren't, you know, quote unquote, correct query letters. Learned a lot from your show about that. And so, yes, it was summer of 2023. I also didn't know all the proper etiquette. So I think I sent out a big batch of pitching agents as well as some small publishers and hybrid publishers. So I had some offers come in. I had a small publisher, a hybrid publisher, and an agent. This was all the summer of 2023, after I had had done the edit with Lori and been working on the draft. And that was an interesting time, because those few offers that came in that summer, and particularly the agent, was very difficult, because after we had our call, I had some yellow flags, and this was the only agent that was interested. And of course, we know it's difficult to get an offer of representation. And I had off and on been trying for about a year at that point. And in the end, I said no to all the offers that were on the table, with having nothing else on the table at the time. And I remember going on a walk that night and just crying. You know, I just was like, what did I do? And I was very unsettled about the options, and I didn't think any of them were right for me and this project and my hopes for the future. It was very hard to say no to an agent and no to publishers when there was nothing else on the table. But in hindsight, of course, I'm glad that I did, because just a couple of months later, I signed with my now agent. And then within a couple of weeks, we had multiple major houses interested. I was speaking with editors. And then we sold the book in a preempt to Simon & Schuster. So that part, you know, it's, once I got to that part, it was very much a whirlwind. It was within weeks of signing with my agent that we sold the book. But I had first had that experience of having to say no to some options that I was unsettled about. So,
yeah, you know what? I love all of that, because it's so difficult to get an agent interested. And so when you get that interest, your first impulse is to just say yes, and ignore all the flags, because you're just so desperate for it. And for those of you who've been querying for longer, you know that. You know, I know some of you have been querying for ages and you're just like, oh my God, if I could just have one agent saying yes. But what Sarah's just said is so important, because it needs to be the right person saying yes. Are you able to share with us what some of the yellow flags were, Sarah, so that our listeners can kind of benefit from that as well?
I can. I'll be a little vague, because I don't necessarily in this format want to expose, you know, who the agent was. But I felt like the vision was actually just very broad. The editors mentioned it just felt extremely broad. And this agent's list was really broad. I felt like there was no specificity. I felt like it was possibly looked down on a little that I didn't have any writing background or an MFA. A couple of comments that were made that made me a little unsettled. But I think the main thing was just the broadness of the vision. And I felt like the editors weren't very specific. And I will say that this was really helpful to me when I signed with the agent that I did sign with, Jane Distel. I had gotten to the point where I decided to work backwards. I got a Publishers Marketplace membership and I started looking into editors, which I had never done before, but there are a lot fewer editors than there are agents out there. And so I just looked at the websites of the major houses and I looked at which editors, you know, if I were to make a list of dream editors. And then I went into Publishers Marketplace and looked at who are those editors doing deals with. That to me was very, I had multiple agents interested after that. I felt like that kind of unlocked the way to target the agent. And what was really affirming to me was when I had the call with the agent that I signed with, she had editors in mind and they all just kind of matched up with the list I had made, not knowing nearly as much as her, nearly as much as she did. And I didn't even tell her, you know, I have this list of editors I've been looking at because I knew, you know, she's the expert. But when she talked about her vision for where my book belonged, what, you know, even I was still struggling with, is this literary fiction? What exactly is it? And she, her vision just completely aligned with mine, unlike the agent that I had ended up saying no to.
I love that querying hack. I hope you're all taking notes. If I was in the querying trenches, I would be taking notes and I'd have light bulbs going off and I'd be like, that is so smart. It really, really is smart. And yeah, you know what? The right agent for you is going to have a very specific vision for your book. You know, when they have this broad vision, it's kind of like, we're going to throw everything against the wall and see what sticks. And that is not a good approach to going out on submission. You know, it should be, I know these editors are going to love this kind of book because this is in their wheelhouse. So yeah, I love that you listen to your gut. And for our listeners, do the same wherever possible. And also, I just want to point out, so for those of you watching on our YouTube channel, this is a stunning advanced reader copy. It is high quality. I mean, you must feel the, I don't know if they, what the heck they even call this here, but the cover glistens inside. It's a ton of endorsements from booksellers. So you can see this is not just a Simon & Schuster title. It is a Simon & Schuster lead title, something that they are putting money behind because they really, really believe in it, which just shows that it ended up with the right editor, the right house. Okay. So Sarah, questions that I have for you. One is, this is such an ambitious debut novel. So just for our listeners, one, okay, we have the prologue and we have an epilogue. But now listen to this. They are in third person point of view. We then have three POV characters throughout the novel that are in first person point of view in three different parts. So it's not chapter one, it's this character, chapter two, it's this character, chapter three, it's this character, and then we rotate through it. It's like we are firmly entrenched in one character's POV. Then a third way through, we go on to the other one. And then at the end, we go to another one, which is so difficult to do. We have a story that spans more than 60 years. 60. That is a hell of a time span. So can we speak about that? Like Sarah, I know when I wrote my debut, which people thought was quite ambitious, I didn't know enough to know it was ambitious and that I shouldn't be trying these things. When you were writing this, did you know it was hugely ambitious or were you just like, yeah, this is kind of what I want to do?
No, I didn't know it was ambitious at all. It just happened very organically. And I will say, I love that you brought up the prologue. That was added after I worked with Lori. So the book starts and ends with the character of Ryan Bright, and that's a flash into his childhood. And that had been there kind of in hindsight. And when she mentioned, maybe we should see that at the beginning, it was like, you know, my experience with editors is about 90% of what they say, even if they don't know the solution, or, you know, they just make a little suggestion, it'll resonate and it'll trigger a thought of, oh, I could do this to fix that problem, or I, you know. And so it was like, as soon as she said, maybe we should see him as a child more at the beginning, it was like, I saw the whole scene. I think I wrote it that day that she, because I got so excited about the suggestion. And I remember thinking, well, I hope this works. You know, the shit no one tells you about writing always tells us to be careful with prologues. So that's where that came from. And initially the book was a novel in letters. And that was how the structure developed, the long period of time in each POV, because it was initially going to be a daughter as she comes of age is receiving a bunch of letters all at once that her mother had been writing over time. And so when I moved the draft from letters into first person present tense, I just kept that same structure that had happened through it having been in letters.
So moving from letters to having this kind of structure, was that something that came with Laurie's suggestion, or had you already changed that before Laurie? Because I'm always fascinated by the evolution of a novel, because this is when you know that something has legs, is when it's been revised, but like not revised that, oh, I'm going to take this paragraph out, oh, I'm going to shove this in there, like a complete overhaul in terms of structure, etc. And then I love seeing that process of how it ends up being the way it was. So at what point did that happen for you?
So that was not something through Laurie. That was when I first was reaching out to agents. Two or maybe three agents responded basically saying, I don't even consider epistolary novels. I don't look at these, are very hard to sell. And so by the time I heard that more than once, I was kind of like, well, maybe I should at least experiment. You know, I wasn't super attached to that structure. And I knew as the creator that I would have to love it if I was going to, you know, basically rewrite it differently. And I, you know, I experimented with a couple of chapters and immediately was like, this is the letters had just been so reflective. And when you're in that first person present tense, you're experiencing it along with the characters. And I think that's more of what contemporary readers are looking for. And I could feel it becoming more compelling. And so I was excited then to kind of take on a rewrite.
Yeah, the problem with epistolary novels is that, you know, it can be so much telling because you are at a place in the future looking back and you are telling what happened and so much time has passed. And so who you are now is different to who you were then when you were experiencing that. And so things don't feel immediate because you bring something from the future. So I think, you know, that's why a lot of agents are not even prepared to look at them because they're just like, this is mostly going to be telling. And it's amazing that even negative feedback, right? Because I think at the time when you were getting those rejections, it was really upsetting to be told, I'm not even going to consider this. But at the time, it was, you know, hard to take on, but you took that feedback and revised because of it. And the novel wouldn't be where it is today without that negative feedback early on, right?
Absolutely. Yes. I'm so thankful to the agents. I know that many of them don't have time to do that, but those who read first pages or read possibly even more than that and gave the feedback that they did, because I was taking all of that and tweaking and seeing if it resonates with me, if this is something I've heard more than once, then let me see how I can improve the manuscript.
I have a ton more questions for Sarah, which we're going to dive into straight after this. But first, a message from our sponsors. Okay, so.
Hey, everybody. Guess who's back from France? I was thinking of you guys listening to me talk about getting ready for the trip and practicing my French while I was doing my best order en français at the cafes. It went well. I was a bit nervous, but when we were in the countryside and I could take my time thinking about what I wanted to say, I was able to say it. Being a bilingual family is high on my list of things that are super important to me as a parent and a mom. If we're going to show them the world, we also need to appreciate and respect the language and culture by learning it. Imagine how much richer your travel experience could be if you could speak the local languages when you travel. With Rosetta Stone, you'll gain the confidence to have real conversations and create deeper connections wherever you go. Rosetta Stone is the trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you naturally absorb and retain your new language on desktop or mobile, whenever and wherever it fits your summer schedule. With 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages to choose from, including Spanish, French, German, Japanese, and more, Rosetta Stone is the go-to tool for real language growth. You can learn faster and retain longer. There's no English translations. You truly learn to speak, listen, and think in your chosen language. There's an intuitive learning process. You start with words, build to phrases, and progress to full sentences. It's designed for long-term retention, so it sticks with you.
You can work on your accent with the built-in True Accent speech recognition technology, so it'll help you sound more natural. You can learn anytime, anywhere. It fits with your lifestyle with a flexible on-the-go learning style, desktop or mobile app. And there's incredible value. A lifetime membership gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. The Shit About Writing listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today.
The holidays are creeping up fast. At the time of recording, I haven't bought a single thing. I'm a last minute gift giver. I will admit that. And I am not afraid to say it. And that is because I know Wayfair has me covered and I can get what I need fast with Wayfair, from last minute guest prep to gifts for everyone's home style. What I love about Wayfair is when we were redesigning our main floor powder room, we were working with a really small space and I knew the dimensions had to be perfect. With Wayfair, I could get a vanity that was exactly my style, warm and modern, in exactly the perfect dimensions. On their easy to navigate website. Our contractor didn't have to wait because the delivery was fast and hassle-free. The new vanity is perfect and we get so many compliments, especially as we have guests flowing through the house this holiday season. I'm getting ready for the cozy guest season with fresh throw blankets, new towels, kitchen essentials for all the meals and dishes that will need to be done. The huge selection of items makes it so easy to shop for everyone in your life and make your house ready for hosting. There's something for every style in every home, no matter your space or budgets. Find all your must-haves and get ready to be surrounded by love and family this season. Get last-minute hosting essentials, gifts for all your loved ones, and decor to celebrate the holidays for way less. Head to wayfair.com right now to shop all things home. That's wayfair.com. Wayfair, every style, every home.
Coming back to that prologue, I love that it was something that was added later and that an editor told you to do it. Again, people, we are not anti-prologue. We are anti-bad prologues, and this was an excellent prologue. So was there a reason why you and Laurie said, okay, you are going to write Ryan in the third person in the prologue, whereas later on his POV is in the first person? What was the intentionality that was brought to that there?
I actually don't know that Laurie and I ever even discussed that. I just wrote it that way. And I think part of that was because in the prologue, Ryan is like 7 years old or something. And I felt like it would be stronger if the voice were a more mature narrator. And I do try to take you kind of into his experience, but I didn't want it to necessarily be a child's voice. And that's similar to the epilogue. I had originally written that in a child's voice and it wasn't working great. And so I think I already had changed that to third person. And so I don't know that I even thought much. I don't even remember making a conscious decision about which narrator to use for the prologue. But then I realized this is really nice how it bookends it with the third person.
Yeah. No, that makes complete sense. In terms of, again, I want to explain to our readers how important intentionality is. So you could have, in some instances, like especially in the early chapters, you could have alternated Ryan and Lillian's POVs. You could have had Lillian speaking, then Ryan's chapter, then Lillian, then Ryan's. Obviously, Georgette's chapters, you couldn't have done that early on because she was only born later. But again, in terms of intentionality, why keep Ryan's POV entirely for the last third of the book for part three, as opposed to interspersing in the beginning? What would that have changed about people's approach to the novel and their understanding of the characters that you didn't necessarily want?
So Ryan is a character who's experiencing a long struggle with alcoholism. And there was something powerful about exploring that through his wife's POV and what it's like to love him through that. And there, especially early in the book, there are a lot of times as a reader, I think, where it's painful, you're frustrated. He's trying and he's failing. He's hurting his family, even though he doesn't want to be doing that. And so we stay with Lillian for a long time to just get very deep and intimate with her into what is that experience like from her perspective. And as you said, Georgette is, we see her we meet Ryan and Millie before she's even born. And then we see her kind of growing up. So by the time we enter her POV, she's a teenager. And that also felt natural. And so once I had those two pieces in place, it was like, now how powerful is it once we've seen Ryan's life play out through the other people's eyes in his family to then see him later in life? So the POVs aren't kind of going back over the same scene from different perspectives. It's more, okay, decades later, let's hear from him now that we've seen all of this life so far. It's time for him to speak, and it's time for him. And by that point, he has changed a lot. When we begin hearing from him, he still is not sober, but he has gained a lot of insight from his experience. And so that's the time when we come into his voice.
Yeah. And it was the perfect time because, like you say, there was this frustration with him. There was this, I was frustrated with Lillian at times. I was like, why are you chasing after this man who just keeps letting you down? Why, you know, like, but hearing his perspective when we did was just incredible. So it was the right choice for the book. I'm going to discuss shortly some descriptions that Sarah's written and her incredible line level writing, including similes and metaphors. For now, I just want to read from your author's notes at the beginning of the book. So it says, working with families for two decades now, I've seen many iterations of my friend's generational cycle. When I started writing The Bright Years, the character who struggles with alcoholism wasn't supposed to be a main character. He was supposed to be an unexplored, absent father, but he refused to stay off the page. So I interviewed people who were generous enough to tell me about their own addictions and loved ones with addictions. Every family I've worked with is its own love story, complete with triumphs and tragedies. And I believe a good novel can do the same thing as a good social worker, help someone feel a little bit less alone. The Bright Family's winding path reflects what I've witnessed in my personal and professional life, from substance abuse to adoption to the shape-shifting of family through marriage and divorce, birth and death. The Brights experienced decades of life together, or as together as they can be, with the burdens they each carry. Throughout the years, their story unspools, and it is one of secrecy and denial, truth and revelation, regret and redemption, inheritance and legacy. And that just like really, really perfectly encapsulates that. When you sat down, were there themes that you knew you wanted very particularly to explore? Or did you sit down and just tell the story with Ryan being like, hello, hello, I want to tell my story, and then afterwards figure out what it was all about?
A little bit of both. The original big theme was this idea of, from the parent and the child side, what is it like to learn your parent? Or what is it like as a parent to let your child know who you are and who you were before they were born, and how that happens over time, and the impact between generations, the way that we can't get away from being impacted by who our parents are. And even in turn, parents can't get away from being impacted by who their children are. And so that was I think the big theme was just, how are we impacted through the generations, but also how there can be some overcoming when there's generational trauma. There's not a magical silver bullet to get rid of it. And yet there can be healing and there can be a redemption that's, you know, hard won through those generations. And so that was the main big theme that I started out with. I did not start out with intending it to be an addiction book or have that be so front and center. But as I said, as I got to know Ryan and tried to just make him kind of be almost a part of Lillian's past, I realized he didn't leave them because he didn't love them. He left them because he loved them. He was trying to protect them from himself. And as is the case with many families who have loved ones with addictions or alcoholism, it's often not a true cutting of ties. It's a very in and out of our lives. And how do we have this relationship with some healthy boundaries, but also with all the love and affection that comes with loving, you know, with someone in your family over a long period of time? So the addiction theme came a little bit later, and then those kind of generational interplays were a big part of the book.
Yeah, we had another interview with Kath Jonathan, who wrote The Resistance Painter, and she also spoke about a character Irena, who she did not want to be on the page. And this character just kept insisting that she had to be in the story. And so she had to learn how to write her. And I love those kinds of characters. I love it when you think the book is about something else and this character is like, no, man, here I am. Please listen to me. And it's wonderful when we as authors specifically listen to that. So I want to read two descriptions that Sarah's written here, just as example of really great character descriptions. Ryan has dark, shaggy hair, paint flecks on his fingers, and beard scruff down his neck, a gap between his two front teeth. His eyes are a sinking dark. I can hardly see the pupil for the iris, like a tree in a night wood. His clothes are plain, his build unthreatening, but not weak. He's like an understated book cover, which is the type I'm inclined to open. So such an incredible description there. And here I want to give you a description of a character of themselves in the first person, because this is something that's always difficult to do because it's weird if a character goes, I have brown hair and blue eyes. So this is from Lillian's POV. While he's in the restroom, I sneak a compact from my purse for a quick face and hair check. Still no makeup and still need a perm. Still dad's thin lips and mama's big eyes and my dark circles. I sigh and snap it shut. So just like a little moment in which to give the reader something of how to imagine that character. Now, something that you have done really, really masterfully is similes and metaphors. Sarah, so I want to read some of them for our listeners. I carry a torn napkin home with Ryan's phone number like a firefly in my pocket. Here we go. After the library and baklava, Ryan and I passed 6 months together with like a morning stretch, that carefree inhale before the day picks up with its work and worries. Here's another one. We've been slow to climb each other's family trees, and I'm reminded of what a daunting climb it can be. Branches might snap. Go. He chews and gulps and blinks, his fork stilling beneath a limp wrist. He never talks about that night, ever. I set my fork down as silence surrounds us like an ambush. I'm finding some more because I really want you all to hear these incredible metaphors and similes. Still, memories creep under doorways like smoke. And another one, when Seth slows down and the kids start to yawn, we walk home under a dimming sky, stubborn streaks of pink slashing through the gray like happiness through grief. So, Sarah, let's talk a bit about writing on the line level, because this is really where great writers are made. It is the building blocks of excellent books. Are you just someone who's really damn good with the similes or metaphors, or is it a case of polishing a gem until it really shines?
I think the similes and metaphors come naturally to the point of multiple times I've had to tone them down, or I realize I have a mixed metaphor in the same paragraph, or it's just too much and I have to cut some of them. So the line level is what I love. And the story and plot are harder for me, and I have to work harder at that. So the character development and the line level comes very naturally. And then I have to figure out, you know, what are we doing here in terms of our story arc?
I mean, if you think about it, this is a quiet book, but it's loud as well. This is the thing. It's quiet in that you would be mistaken if you say not much happens, because it's real life. It's things that happen to real people every single day. And most of these things aren't even big enough for somebody to like write a memoir that is guaranteed to get published, right? A lot of people write these kinds of memoirs and publishers are like, we see this every day. This isn't a special story. And yet, you know, you make the story so loud and you make the everyday so compelling through the force of the brilliant interiority, the emotionality, and the line level writing. So, I mean, how long did this take you to write from start to finish through all of its iterations?
Great question. So the first draft I did kind of late 2021, and I am not an outliner, so a complete pantser. So I knew the title and I knew the final scene and I didn't really know anything else. And so I drafted it within about 2 months because I just couldn't stop. It was so much, it was like reading, but better because I was every day discovering what's happening to these characters. So because I draft so quickly, I spend a lot of time in revision and doing rewrites. And so then I actually put it away and kind of forgot about it because at that point I wasn't really thinking publishing for at least 6 months. I mean, I was doing other things, writing other things, not thinking about that manuscript. And then when I came back to it in the summer of 2022, that's when I really was like, I'm going to learn more about the publishing industry. And I spent the next year really doing revisions. That's when I heard from those agents, you know, we're not interested in epistolary and all of that. And so it was from start to finish in terms of when I signed my book contract, it was about 2 years. So some of that, again, at least 6 months, I didn't look at it at all. The first draft was very fast and then just a lot of time in the revision stage.
Yeah, that time away from a manuscript is so important. Sometimes we feel like we're giving up on a book when we walk away, but I think sometimes it's the best thing we can do for the book is giving ourselves that clarity. Right, we're at the end of our time. For our listeners, we're linking to the Bright Years on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you get it there, you support an independent bookstore and the podcast at the same time. Please get this book, read it. You're going to underline it like crazy. Have your highlighter next to you because you're going to need it. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me, Bianca.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. Hi there. We've got a lot we're really excited to tell you about, but I'm going to make this real quick so you can get to the episode. The deep dive is coming up at the end of January. The lineup of speakers is incredible and the range of topics is mind-blowing. You do not want to miss out on the last deep dive ever. Then the beta reader matchup is open once again with the matchups going out early in February. Sign up to kick your creative year off with a bang. Lastly, there's an amazing writer's workbook available, which will make the perfect gift for you or the writer in your life. Head to our website, The Shit About Writing, to find out more.